I will start with just a real life case presentation that we have encountered recently at the oncology department at Maqasid. Mrs. N.I. is a 75-year-old woman. She was blind, and she has large cell B lymphoma, and she is controlled. She's still living. Sorry, I'm saying talking in the past tense. She has large B-cell lymphoma, and it is controlled with chemotherapy, and she was admitted because of generalized weakness, decreased appetite of 2 days' duration. Upon presentation of physical exam, the blood pressure was okay. The pulse was a little bit high. It was 120 per minute, and the temperature was 38.5. The general physical exam was physiological. Nothing was really gross, including the eye exam and the lung exam. And her absolute neutrophil count was 1,000, so it was at the limit for neutropenia. And her procalcitonin was elevated, 28, CRP 25, and serum creatinine 1.1. Her platelet counts was 110,000. Because of her history of lymphoma and chemotherapy and borderline neutropenia, the patient, although she had a normal chest X-ray, but because she was febrile, and severely resistant organism screen was taken, and the patient was started on carbapenem. She did very well, and she improved. She started eating on day 3, and she improved markedly. However, the fever subsided, and we were very happy. And then on day four, patients started to have bloody lacrimation. She started to have blood out of her eyes, and the physical exam of the eye was really horrifying. This was the physical exam of the eye. The eye upon presentation, both eyes, although the patient was blind, both eyes were, the inspection of both eyes was completely normal upon presentation. We definitely consulted an ophthalmologist and the ophthalmologic exam showed severe inflammation with pus and bleeding in the vitreous humor, and her platelet count were still 100,000, so it was not a thrombocytopenia. And because of the severe inflammation, we suspected an infection in the eye, a streptococcal infection, because I missed to tell you that we recovered from blood streptococcus pneumoniae on day 4. So we were happy with the streptococcus pneumoniae, and it was susceptible to penicillin and responding to the carbapenem. However, she started having this infection of the eye, and because the antibiotics do not penetrate the eye, we suspected that this is the strep pneumoniae causing this infection. We started her on eye drops with quinolone, and the patient improved, and the eye exam became normal again as it was at baseline like 4 weeks later. So this is an example of a strep pneumonia infection that really affected the patient systemically. We had an invasive streptococcal pneumonia infection, and it was really a dangerous eye infection that even antibiotics could not do anything about this patient because the antibiotics do not penetrate the eye. So the question here, if we have given this, if this patient was already vaccinated for streptococcal pneumonia, would her course change? Would she be admitted for this infection? Would the coming infections be different? Because this patient had a superimposed catheter-associated urinary tract infection with an ESBL, and she received a carbapenem. And we expect that later on, after the carbapenem, she will have also other ESBL infections, and maybe carbapenemase gram-negative bacteria infection, or even an XDR acinetobacter infection, because these are very known. The fact of receiving carbapenem is a very known risk factor for these XDR and PANDR infections. So if we have vaccinated this patient, maybe the coming course also of this patient would be different, knowing that she is 75-year-old with a cancer on chemotherapy, that maybe the remaining time of her life is not that long. So I will take you into a journey now just to check, is vaccination worth giving in this patient and similar patients, and even less sick patients or not. And definitely I'm talking about vaccination with against Streptococcus pneumoniae. So we'll start with the burden of Streptococcus pneumoniae. I'm talking to an audience that knows very well, and all of you have seen the severity and the importance of streptococcal pneumonia infection, but I will just repeat a little bit. We'll see here that the pneumococcal infection can be either invasive infection or only mucosal infections. And whenever they are invasive infection, they are recovered from the blood or from a sterile site, and they cause meningitis or bacteremia. And in non-invasive, they cause pneumonia or acute otitis media. The point with these infections is that mortality is very high with the invasive infections. It can reach up to 30% in meningitis. However, in the non-invasive, mortality is much less, but the number of patients having non-invasive pneumococcal infections are really very high. And we can see this in this pyramid where majority of patients have pneumonia, it's true, but and the top of the pyramid is only patients who have meningitis. The top of the pyramid are patients who have very high mortality, but the bottom, we have a very large number reaching 500,000 per year in the United States, and this, and 40% of these patients are hospitalized. So streptococcal pneumonia, although not the majority are having invasive infection, but also mucosal infection causes a big burden on the health system. It causes hospitalization and morbidity, superimposed XDRs, and definitely in our days now, we are keen on limiting the infections with the extended spectrum betalactamase infections and extended spectrum antibiotic resistant bacteria, and limiting these infections might limit this the spread of these bacteria. I will start here talking about a little bit the impact of community-acquired pneumonia in different countries. Community-acquired pneumonia that requires hospitalization is a big constitutes a big number of patients who have community-acquired pneumonia. In Brazil, almost 50% of the patients who have community-acquired pneumonia are hospitalized, and in other parts of the world, it varies between 20 and 50%. We know that hospitalization means severe illness, or patients that are debilitated, or patients that are at high risk that are being hospitalized. If we look in our region, if we look at the numbers from Qatar, we see that the cases admitted to a medical ICU for more than 48 hours and receiving antibiotics, 42% of them have community-acquired pneumonia. In patients in Saudi Arabia, the hospitalized cases of community-acquired infections, 30% of them have community-acquired pneumonia. And so on. So community-acquired pneumonia causes a huge number of admission to the hospital, and then, as we all know, complications and a huge cost. These are the guidelines of the Infectious Disease Society of America talking about community-acquired pneumonia. And in these guidelines, based on statistics, we can see that Streptococcus pneumoniae is the leading organism in all types of community-acquired pneumonia. Whether the patients are outpatients, the most common organism is Streptococcus pneumoniae. Whether the patients are hospitalized on regular wards, still the leading organism is Streptococcus pneumoniae. And whether the patients are admitted to intensive care units, still the leading organism is Streptococcus pneumoniae. So treating community-acquired pneumonia, we have number one to treat the Streptococcus pneumonia. And preventing community-acquired pneumonia, it follows that we have to prevent Streptococcus pneumonia infection as well. If we look at this slide, we see the epidemiologic conditions that are risk factors for community-acquired pneumonia and are present here, like alcoholism, COPD, lung abscesses, HIV infection, and in all of these infections, we see that Streptococcus pneumonia is either a leading organism or one of the leading organisms. It is a leading organism in alcoholism, in COPD patients, in smokers, in patients with obstruction, in patients where influenza is circulating in the community. In all of these conditions, Streptococcus pneumonia becomes the leading organism in community-acquired pneumonia. So that we'll start with the invasive pneumococcal infections, and as definition, invasive pulmonary pneumococcal infections are infections where we recover the organism from sterile sites like the blood, the CSF, the joint, the eye. So all of these are signs of invasive infections. And if we can see here that the incidence of invasive pneumococcal infections in developed world is quite significant, is around 15% in most of the developed world. This is in the general population. However, if we look at the aged population, patients that are 65 years or older, we see that the rate is much higher than in the general population, and we see that in patients that are above 65, the rate of pneumococcal disease in developed countries can reach sometimes 75 cases in 100,000 person per population. So this is a really common disease, and it affects much more the aged population rather than the younger, and definitely there is a specific subgroup in the younger population. If we look here at the childhood immunization, if we look here at the incidence of invasive pulmonary disease by age in USA, we see that there are two peaks of age for invasive pulmonary disease. One peak is at the age of 2 years, and another peak is at the age above 65. And even here, we can see that in England, the peak of age more than 65 is even higher than the peak of their patients. Less than 2 years. Also in the United States, we see the same curve, and from here we have to know that the risk of streptococcus pneumonia in the patients above 65 is at least as equal as in children less than 2 years of age. And from here, if we think about the vaccination schedule of children less than 2 years of age, vaccination against streptococcus pneumonia, and specifically against with the conjugated vaccine, is recommended in most of the countries. And even in Lebanon, the Lebanese Ministry of Health is giving free of charge for children less than 2 years the vaccination with the 13 Prevnar, with the 13 conjugated anti-pneumococcal vaccine. So if we look at the incidence, we might wonder, why are we leaving behind the 65 or above, since the incidence is almost the same, if not higher. And we'll see if the mortality is the same or if the morbidity is the same or not. And this is another slide that shows us that the comorbidities can increase the invasive pneumococcal disease in adults at all ages. We see that from the previous slides, if the patients don't have any morbidity, like in the none, the risk is 5.4 case fatality rate. So the mortality in patients who don't have any risk factor is around 5%, while it increases, reaching 37% in patients who have chronic liver disease, and sometimes in patients that have chronic heart disease, 19%, and patients that have chronic pulmonary disease, around 18%. Add to this, when we look at patients that are above 65 years of age and having comorbidity, that even the risk is much higher for having for mortality when the patients have invasive pulmonary pneumococcal disease. So mortality increases whenever the age increases, and it increases as well with the different risk factors. So why aren't we preventing pneumococcal disease in the elderly? This is up to us, since it's not still recommended in Lebanon from the Lebanese Ministry of Health. However, with our patients, we have to remember that mortality is higher whenever patients are above 65 and they have risk factors, and they are infected with an invasive type of infection with pneumococcal disease, and they are at higher risk than other patients with invasive pulmonary disease. If we look at this slide, we see that in our region, from WHO data, the Middle Eastern region has the highest incidence of invasive pulmonary disease, pneumococcal disease, and the highest mortality of invasive pulmonary disease. So in our area, because of the lack of vaccination in 2016, the rate of death and the rate of infection with pneumococcal disease is higher than other areas of the world. This is another slide that shows us that in England also that the peak of pneumococcal disease and invasive pneumococcal disease is also the young children 2 years and less, and also in patients above 65 years of age. So we have always to think about the two extremes of life, and I think we have to build up this mentality of having vaccination in the two extremes of life because of the waning immunity when the patients become 65 years or older. This is the immunization schedule for the children, and this is just to show you that Prevnar, which is PV13, is recommended in children less than 2 years of age that are really similar in their incidence and in their mortality to patients that are 65 years or older. The factors that are associated with risk for invasive pulmonary disease and for pneumococcal disease, I'm sure you all know them. I will just remind you of these factors. So being elderly, more than 50 or more than 65 is a risk factor. Being immunocompetent with coronary disease, with cardiac disease, with liver disease, chronic kidney disease, dialysis, pulmonary illnesses, CSF leak, cochlear implant, asplenia, all of these are risk factors for having pneumococcal disease. In addition to patients that are immunocompromised, also these patients are at higher risk of pneumococcal disease, like patients with HIV, patients with cancer, be it solid tumors or hematologic tumors, or patients with bone marrow transplant, or patients with primary immunotherapy, or patients that have chronic diseases on chronic corticosteroids. All of these patients are at higher risk for pneumococcal disease. External factors like patients that are living in nursing homes or people that now are living in camps and the people that are living in crowded areas, all of these are at a higher risk of pulmonary disease. And definitely behavior like smoking and alcoholism puts patients at a much higher risk of pulmonary disease. If we look at the high-risk patients versus patients that are at risk, so the high-risk patients are the patients that we all know are at high risk for pulmonary disease, like the immunocompromised patients, HIV patients, cancer patients, bone marrow transplant patients. However, the patients at risk are the patients that people are less aware of the risk for pulmonary disease, like the patients with chronic cardiac disease, pulmonary disease, smoker, alcoholics, liver disease, dialysis patient, diabetic patients. We see that if we look here, the different column gives different number of risk factors, and the black columns represents patients that have more than three risk factors, which is usually we encounter in our clinical practice. Always when residents are talking to us about patients, they tell you the first song. We have cardiac hypertensive, COPD, or chronic renal failure patients. So this patient has already three or four risk factors for pulmonary disease. And we see that these patients that have more than three or more risk factors for pneumococcal disease are at a higher risk for pulmonary disease and even mortality than patients that are already immunocompromised that we know, like the cancer patients or the patients on chemotherapy. So at risk is as important in terms of incidence of infection as well as mortality as it is as important as high-risk patients for having pneumococcal disease. The mortality for such infections in meningitis, it reaches 35% in patients that are 65 or older, and the bacteremia, it reaches around 20% in these patients, and pneumonia reaches as well 7 to 9% in patients that are 65 years or older. So this is a serious disease that is a very common one, definitely causing pneumonia, and a very important cause of community-acquired pneumonia, whether patients are hospitalized or treated at home, in the ICU or on the wards, and mortality is really substantial, and the numbers are really very, very big. I would like to share with you this paper done here in Lebanon by a group at the American University of Beirut, where by Dr. Hannah Wakim and Dr. Dweibo et al., who have gathered the Streptococcus pneumoniae strains from all over the country, but for 5 years, I think, it was between 2005 and 2011, and they took all the invasive strains and they studied them and they stratified them according to if they caused the severe infection, mortality, what strains, what was the antibiotic susceptibility of these strains. And they found that the patients that were less than 2 years of age, they had the penicillin non-susceptibility, resistance to penicillin in their strains around 30%, and patients above 60 years, there was about 13% resistant to penicillin. And this definitely will predispose patients to have a more complicated course, because penicillin definitely is the first line of treatment for Streptococcus pneumonia classically. So whenever now we're dealing with the strains that are more resistant, and we'll see if they are more virulent or not. And even they found that there was ceftriaxone resistance, erythromycin resistance, and many types of multi-drug resistance as well. The serotypes found in Lebanon, they were serotypes 19, 6, 3, 14, and 1. All of these serotypes are present in the, most of these serotypes are present in the polyvalent 13 vaccine. And here we can see that the different vaccines, we see that in the different vaccine, the blue vaccine, the blue circle, has the serotypes that are not present in PV13, but present in the PV23. And the two other serotypes are, two other circles contain the serotypes that are present in PV13. And we see, and if we look at the virulent strains that are yellow, these virulent strains are all present in the PV13 vaccine. So most of the strains that were recovered in Lebanon from invasive pulmonary disease were present in the PV13. Some of them were present only in the PV23. However, the most virulent were all present in the PV13 vaccine. Other people did the same studies and they found similar results, like Rodriguez in Spain and Mukaddas in Kuwait. They also found similar serotypes present in their invasive pulmonary disease, and all of these serotypes were present in the PV13. And if we look at the non-susceptibility to penicillin, well, the non-susceptibility to penicillin was present mostly in serotype 19F, followed by 6 and 14, and the Mukaddas in Kuwait found something similar also to our data. 19F and 6B and 14 also were predominant among the strains that were resistant to penicillin. So the serotypes included in PCV13, but not in 7, constituted 7.14% of the Lebanese penicillin invasive pneumococcal strains. In antibiotic-resistant strep pneumonia, this is really a global concern. And if we look at the statistics in the Far East, definitely they have the highest numbers with pneumococcus that are resistant to penicillin. However, next to the Far East, if we look at the Middle East, we find that our rates are really very high. Definitely the rate of resistance to Streptococcus pneumonia depends whether we're looking at strains that are causing meningitis or pneumonia. But irrespective, this shows that we have a creeping, increasing MIC level to penicillin in our Streptococcus pneumonia, and really treatment is not, in a public health vision, is not the only solution, or is not the solution. Definitely in a public health vision, the prevention is the best solution. And if we look at the armamentarium of drugs that will be considered for treatment of strep pneumonia, we find that penicillin, the cephalosporins, the quinolones, and the linezolids, and the erythromycin, the macrolides, the clindamycin, and all of these, antibiotics have shown non-activity in some of the strains against Streptococcus pneumonia. In 2010, I think a group also from AUB have reported resistance to quinolone, which we usually give happily whenever we have streptococcal pneumonia infection. However, even with quinolone, although the numbers are still low, with 98% susceptibility, but resistance is really emerging, and we have really learned in a bad way that once resistance starts to emerge, it goes really very fast. So treating is, whenever we have treatment, definitely we have treatment, but we cannot really depend on treatment for these infections. We really need something stronger in order to prevent our population from dying and suffering from such infections. This is the data from Dr. Araj from here, lower the 2014-2015 for strep pneumo. We find that the resistance to penicillin is 32%, for clindamycin 73%, for levo, sorry, this is the susceptibility. Susceptibility to penicillin is 32%, for clinda 73%, and for levo 98%. So this is a change from the 100% that we are used to. So whenever we're talking antibiotics, this is our area. Antibiotics, we give antibiotics, we select resistance. And this is well known, and we have seen this with most of the strains. And we have now, we are all suffering from extensively resistant bacteria in our ICUs and in our hospitals. And giving antibiotic is only needs only time to really select for the resistant strains, while with vaccination, really, with this phenomenon does not occur. So especially when the vaccine has a herd effect and it prevents the infection from the beginning in all the population. So the effect of vaccination outweighs a lot the effect of treatment, and definitely us infectious diseases at least, and definitely the pulmonary physicians as well would like to prevent such illnesses in their patients, and we'll see how we can do it. So if we go back to our patient, she improved, as I said, on treatment, and we were all happy, but then she developed an ESBL and she received a carbapenem, and I said, as I said before, what will happen later, we don't know, but we can expect that she will have an XDR infection, and maybe this will affect her longevity, and definitely it will affect her her life. So what can we do with vaccination? This is a statement that came out from WHO in 2008, where they said that definitely after they have looked at the numbers of strep pneumo in different parts of the globe, that a vaccine is recommended. And a vaccine has to be conjugated to give a better effect. And this is a vaccine is recommended to prevent strep pneumo, because strep pneumo is really a disease that causes high mortality and drains a lot of the economies of the countries. So the types of vaccine, definitely there are the conjugated and the non-conjugated vaccines. I will go quickly about what is conjugated and what is non-conjugated. We have in the market the haemophilus vaccine is a conjugated vaccine. The meningitis vaccine, the Neisseria vaccine, is now the conjugated vaccine, and the pneumococcal vaccine is the conjugated vaccine. Conjugation is really when we put the vaccine is the polysaccharide of the bacteria that is presented to the immune system. Usually this polysaccharide, it is a weak immunogenic, it gives an immunogenic response, but with a very short memory whenever it is alone. With conjugation, we put the polysaccharide with a protein, and we bind the protein to the polysaccharide, and the protein makes beautiful results. It helps the immune system to remember this polysaccharide, because it helps the T cells to see this this polysaccharide, this antigen, and build up memory cells in order to remember whenever the body encounters this infection. So this is a scheme that shows the conjugation, the difference between non-conjugated, which is a polysaccharide with only B cells that are reactive to the polysaccharide, while with conjugation we have T cells that are active, and T cells present giving memory, and then the memory will give a prolonged effect, and that's why with the conjugated vaccines we don't need to give multiple vaccinations. One single vaccination is enough, compared to the other vaccines when we have to give, as you know, in the PV23 23 non-conjugated vaccine, we have to give 5 vaccinations. Definitely in children, we have to give multiple vaccinations. In bone marrow transplant patients, we have to give multiple vaccinations because the immune system is still weak and still young, and can, maybe we are the build-up of memory cell is not easily done, and repetition is needed. However, whenever there is a more or less normal immune system, a single vaccination is needed because of the presentation by a protein of the antigen and build up of the memory cells for these vaccines. So conjugated vaccine has been proven to be really effective, and we have seen in PV7, and the most important thing that we have seen is the herd immunity. So if we vaccinate half the population, maybe the other half will be vaccinated immediately from their peers because of the herd immunity that is proven in these conjugated vaccines. This is another slide that shows us that the most of the serotypes that have caused the invasive pulmonary disease in Lebanon are all present. Most of them are present in the PV13. Some of them are not present, but they were not really very common. I will skip the slide of serotypes. I think we have talked enough about serotypes. I want to share with you this slide where we showed that the mortality of pneumococcal infections has been going with time to be stable. It has been before the antibiotics around 12% or around, yes, 12 to 13%. And in 2001, it has, which was the peak of antibiotics, where the resistance of the 21st century was not really prominent like it is now, it was still 12%. So antibiotics really have not changed much. They did change a lot, and antibiotics have really revolutionized the world. However, still in the pneumococcal vaccine, mortality is still the same from the 1960s till 2001, and what to come now in the era of multidrug resistance. This study is called the CAPITA study, where they tried vaccinating people in Holland, in the Netherlands. They chose the Netherlands because in the Netherlands, the health system does not vaccinate people with the non-conjugated vaccine when they are above 65. In other areas of Europe, the patients that are above 65 at that time were recommended to be vaccinated with the PV23. So these patients are naive for vaccinations. This population is naive for vaccination for pneumococcus, and they have chosen in the Netherlands, they took 8,000 patients, 84,000 volunteers, half of them, all of them above 65, half of them received the PV13, and the other half were kept as they usually are with placebo, and they looked at the how much community-acquired pneumonia has been caused in these two groups, compared the two groups in terms of community-acquired pneumonia due to serotypes of pneumococcus that are present in the vaccine, how much invasive pulmonary infection has happened and non-invasive infections has happened. So the first episode of confirmed vaccine-type pneumococcal CAP was found to be double in the placebo compared to the Prevnar group. This same thing was not proven with the non-conjugated vaccine. So this is the superiority of the conjugation, where it decreased the CAP, the total CAP in the population due to the vaccine serotypes, while the non-conjugated vaccine showed an effect in the invasive pulmonary disease, not in CAP in general. Definitely it showed an effect on the invasive pneumococcal disease as well as non-invasive pneumococcal disease. So this study was the turning point of many countries to introduce the conjugated 13 pneumococcal vaccine and to integrate it in their health policies. We'll talk about some recommendations of these countries. I'll start definitely with the ACIP in the United States, where the Advisory Committee for Immunization Practices guidelines, and they recommend the recommendations are for patients that are naive with vaccination or patients who have been already vaccinated. And if the patients have already been vaccinated for PV23, then there should be some lag time before giving if they want to give the PV13. If the patients are naive, patients should be started with the PV13. The recommendation in patients that are immune immunocompetent, however, they have risk factors like asplenia, cochlear implant, CSF leak. These patients are recommended to receive the PV13, even if they are less than 50. At any age, they are recommended to receive the PV13. So, as I said before, if they have already received the PV23, there should be a lag period of 1 year before giving the PV13. In patients, these are patients that are already at risk, and we all know they need pneumococcal vaccination. However, if we look, if we look at the recommendation for patients that are at risk, we see that still in the ACIP, the recommendation is to vaccinate patients with CSF leak, cochlear implants, so patients with sickle disease, and patients with immunodeficiencies all over. But we have seen that patients that are at risk have all the patients that are at risk in the previous slide. I will show it here, I think. Yes. The patients that are at risk with multiple comorbidities have the same chance of acquiring pneumococcal disease and dying from pneumococcal disease like the patients that are known to be immunodeficient and known to be at risk for pneumococcal disease. The time sequence of PV13 and PV23, as I said before, there should be at least 1 year in between, and if the recommendation, if the patient hasn't received any vaccination, then to start with the PV13 and give 6 months to 1 year, and now the recommendation is mostly 1 year, the PV23 later. And if the patient needs to have the PV23 repeated to be repeated after 5 years, and there is no need to repeat the PV13 because of the story of the conjugation and the memory cells. I want to share with you our experience at the Maqasid Hospital.
5 minutes.
Pneumonia. Oh, okay. This is a small review that we have done at the Maqasid for strep pneumonia to show the effect, the mortality, and the effect of pneumococcal infections in our population. The populations that we studied were not vaccinated, although our physicians do vaccinate their patients. However, we can get patients from all over. And we studied the strep pneumo cases between 2014 and 2015 and the beginning of 2016. And we found 30, we looked at the characteristics, the invasiveness, the association with mortality, and the superimposed XDR infections, and we found that the total numbers were 30, 9 pediatrics and 21 adults, so the adults were more prone to have infections than the pneumococcal infection than the pediatric age, and we had 3 cases less than 65, and most of the cases were above 65, and from the patients less than 65, most of them had comorbidities. So being above 65 was the major risk factor, and having comorbidities was also another risk factor. I will skip a little bit our study, but this is what we have seen at Maqasid in 2 years. Elderly patients coming with streptococcal pneumonia, patients with comorbidities, much more than patients that are immunocompromised the classical way. And if we look at the diabetic guidelines for pneumococcal vaccination, we see that the Diabetic Society of America also, they recommend the PV13 vaccination for their patients, and the Oncology Society also recommends vaccination with the PV13 followed by PV23 for their patients as well. And we have here the schemes for different neighboring countries, and we see, because of the shortage of time, I cannot go into details. However, just as general view, the most of the Gulf countries do recommend PV13 as a vaccination for their population when they are above 50, and some of them above 65, and mainly when they go to the pilgrims at the time of the pilgrim. So maybe the turning point for decision is the amount of money and the price of the pneumococcal vaccine and the richness of the country, but definitely the importance of pneumococcal infection and the effectiveness of the vaccine in preventing such infections and in preventing mortality from these infections was the key point in taking these decisions. So we have it in Saudi, we have it in Dubai, in Qatar, everywhere. So I will stop here and The floor is open for questions.
Thank you, Dr. Magni, for this very detailed and interesting presentation. The floor is open for questions. Yes, please.
Thank you for your talk. Did you see allergic reaction to this vaccine?
I vaccinate a lot of my patients, and I haven't. What I saw many times, some local reaction that subsides within a few days, but I didn't see severe allergic reactions in my practice. Although I vaccinate a lot, and I have a clinic just for vaccinating the cancer patients of our hospital, so I haven't.
Dr. Assassin.
In oncology, patients who are undergoing chemotherapy, what is the ideal time to give them the PV13?
When they are in remission. When they are in remission is the ideal time. Otherwise, you give it...
Because we are facing a lot of problems with the oncologist. They are... they refuse most of the time to give them the vaccine so early.
Yeah, the recommendation is to give it either before starting any treatment or when the patients are in remission. And in bone marrow transplant, it's 1 year after transplantation.
Okay, thank you.
If the patient had a respiratory infection with streptococcus this year, can we do the vaccine this year or we have to wait?
Yes, when the patient is cured and is fine, you can do the vaccination.
How much time do we wait after the infection?
I don't have evidence-based answer, but I would think like 6 months would be enough because from the guidelines, 6 months were accepted as a lag period between the two vaccinations. So even if the patient has received the PV23, you can give after 6 months the PV13, which means that it will not cause an immunologic reaction. So I would think after 6 months, you can vaccinate.
Okay. And after a respiratory infection, not due to streptococcus, do we have to wait?
No, you give it whenever the patient, you feel that patient is back to his normal health status, you can give it.
Okay, and one more question concerning pneumo 23. We can't find it easily.
Yes.
What do you do?
We have to give it because it is in the recommendations, and especially in high-risk patients, and patients at risk, some of the patients at risk. What we're doing, we're just vaccinating with PV13 and hoping that we'll work with the ministry to get the PV23 into the country.
The time between splenectomy, urgent splenectomy, and the administration of Prevnar.
What we usually do, we try to give it even before the operation. But if not, after the patient recovers and back to his normal health, you have to give the vaccination. Usually it is 8 weeks, but sometimes the patient develops a superimposed infection, so you don't give at 8 weeks. When the patient has recovered, you can give the vaccination.
But the sooner is better.
Yeah, but the patient has to really recover before.
Do you give credit to complete the pneumococcal vaccination with an immunostimulation, for instance, to other common bacteria, such as Staphylococcus aureus or Haemophilus influenzae that we know exist in some formulation of companies like Broncovaxom by OM company, for instance, to complete it eventually.
Tell you the truth, I have no experience and I have not read about this topic, but I can tell you that co-vaccination with other vaccines can be done. And we always recommend vaccinating at the beginning of the season, vaccinating with the grip vaccine, with the flu vaccine and the pneumococcal vaccine at the same time. But I don't have any experience with the immuno...
There is a vaccine for the hemophilus.
Yes, the vaccination, but not the immunostimulation.
Staph, no.